Good afternoon. I'm really glad to be here. I'm really glad to have gotten to sit down with most of you for a little bit. I wanted to start with a poem because I'm especially inspired by poems. This one's called Lousy at Math, and it's by Hafiz. Once a group of thieves stole a rare diamond larger than two goose eggs. Its value could have easily bought 3,000 horses and 3,000 acres of the most fertile land in Shiraz. The thieves got drunk that night to celebrate their great haul. But during the course of the evening, the effects of the liquor and their mistrust of each other grew to such an extent they decided to divide the stone into pieces. Of course, then, the priceless became lost. Most everyone is lousy at math and does that to God, dissects the indivisible one by thinking, by saying, this is my beloved, and he looks like this and acts like that. How could that moron over there really be God? And this is what Jordan was talking about yesterday. And we do this with thinking of ourselves as a separate self and thinking of others as others completely separate from us. When we do it within our own selves, denying parts of ourselves, dividing it up, saying this part's good, this part's not okay. And that's kind of what I wanted to talk about. So, because it's the same mistake. And it's the one that is the easiest one for us to, it's much easier for us to not see that completely or to forget very easily, at least in my personal experience. So I want to talk about being human and being on this path. That's not really a path because it's the present moment that's our path. And everything that happens, every learning, every bit of learning, growth, healing, every insight happens when we're present to what's happening in the moment, right now. What I've learned a lot about this past year is that it takes a great deal of patience, kindness, compassion, love, willingness, acceptance, courage toward ourselves in order to continue to move forward on the path. And all of the ways that we can avoid doing that. So, let's see. It's very easy to avoid something that's unpleasant. It's very easy to do that. It's a survival instinct, of course. And so there's that. And yet, because we've developed it so skillfully and so carefully over however many millennia, I'm not really good with all that history. But we're really good at the avoiding, and it's something that we can do in so many different ways. The main basic ways are dulling out, which we can do in many different ways. It's a form of ignorance. So there's the three poisons they talk about in Buddhism, the ignorance. And we become ignorant when we dull out through any kind of mind-altering substance that we abuse or any kind of activity that might dull the mind. I mean, it could just be watching a lot of movies or television or what, computer games. What?
Internet.
Internet, Facebook, or whatever your flavor is of that. You can seek pleasure through the internet, potentially like shopping on Amazon, or shopping, eating, sex, pleasure, which is all, none of these things are bad things. It's about using them, and we do this automatically. There's also the anger, aggression, aversion part, blaming, resentment, using that. Like some people have, we all have our different propensities. I have two favorites. You probably have your own favorite one or two, or go-to ones. And so we do that. And we do that in our day-to-day life. And then we get on, we start to meditate and we start to practice, and then things can get hairy because we see there's those distractions, those internets and sex and the you know, blaming people. You can't look at them really very much, you know, so you can blame them in your mind. You can, but you can watch yourself do it a little easier if you allow that to happen. And you can also, but the main thing that I wanted to talk about too is how we do that toward the parts of ourselves and the aspects of ourselves that we find difficult to accept and difficult to swallow or difficult to see. And it's the same mistake, and it's human. It's a human thing. And it's what we came here to look at. It's what we came here to be with. It's the key, you know, treating those places in ourselves with kindness, compassion, patience, curiosity, wonder, love, steadfastness and diligence, you know, being willing. Those things, that's what we came here for. And so in my own life, I'll just give you a personal little story. So, when I first started exploring spirituality in beyond the confines of Catholicism that I had practiced my whole life, and it happened because, well, it happened for a whole lot of things happened, but, you know, my mother died, and that was one thing. That was 13, 14 years ago. And there was a lot of life events happening. There had been happening that were very challenging. And there was a lot of suffering that I was seeing in myself and in others, and it didn't make sense. And the answers that I had and the model that I had to work with didn't answer questions. And I really love to see everyone when I'm talking, and I'm struggling because I'm not seeing Ted and I'm not seeing Jessica. So I'm going to move this way just a smidge. But I'm wondering, Ted, would you be willing to move to your left? And Jessica, would you be willing to move to your right? And I can see a little bit of Andrea and Nick, so I'm okay. I can see a little, yeah. Thank you. That makes me feel really connected. And I can see Cynthia every so often. Okay, thank you. So I didn't have the answers. And I didn't know what the answers were, and I didn't know, I didn't even realize that that's what I was looking for, or what I was looking for. I just knew that there was a restlessness and a discomfort and a desire to understand something that I hadn't been able to understand. Why do things happen the way they do, and why is it so painful? And then I thought that would somehow lead to, as others may have made this mistake, you may have been much wiser than me, that would lead to a place of pretty much constant pleasantness, or, you know, persistent pleasantness. I was hoping, you know, at least, right? You know, I was really hoping. And then, you know, so lots of things happened, and I ended up strongly pursuing a path now I look back and go, yeah, of course you did, that there was a lot of magical thinking about the way that enlightenment would happen and how that would be this instant blissful state, and that would, I had this, you know, and I wanted to believe that, or I wouldn't have been able to, because it doesn't, you know, it's not logical, or doesn't, anyway, I wanted to believe it, and so I did, and to the extent that I did benefit a lot from many teachings and from a lot of things that I learned through that path on many levels. I not only benefited from becoming a better person because I became more ethical, which did happen, but I also benefited from learning lessons about the mistakes that I made in the assumptions that I made about what was true. And it was me who was doing that. The teachers may have not meant to teach things that would ultimately cause me to suffer. And yet, you know, those things did happen. And also, so there were many valuable lessons, and it was a powerful, continues to be a powerful teaching, and many teachings. And so there was all this suffering and pain, and it would intermittently feel better, and I loved all the magical stuff. And I went into a 3-year retreat essentially the first of 2011. And with the group of people and one of the teachers who had been teaching these methods and practiced a lot of the practices, which were very valuable to me, actually, and are very valuable, and did do a lot of good things, and also ultimately came to their own end or conclusion in my life. And anyway, they taught what they were going to teach, and then there was this like rather dramatic shift in a lot of things, a rather dramatic shift in the retreat and then the teachings and the teacher. And so then I got to sit with all of that for a long time. And at first, what it did was it brought up everything, all my shortcomings, it brought up everything that I did that was blocking me on the path, and then I just started doing it more and doing it harder for a little while, or it seemed like, until I couldn't. And that also proved to be very valuable, because there was a lot of surrender at that point. And it was around that time that I started getting in touch with Chula Dasa and wanting to become an adept meditator. So I wrote to him. It took me days to write that letter. There was a lot to try to put into a few pages, because I hadn't seen him in 2 years, or close to that. So. And maybe I've told you guys this story, but it's okay. This is a new twist, I think. And so then I did that, got in touch with him, and realized there was this, like, a calling is what I remember thinking of it. It was like a calling to master meditative stillness. I think I can do that, but I was so afraid to admit it out loud. Like, no, I'm not. And so, but then I got a letter back from him pretty quickly saying, I have no doubt you can be a master meditator. I'm so glad you got in touch with me. Let's stay in touch. I'll send you drafts of the book. And so a lot of things happened even after that that were difficult. And I was in retreat with a partner, and that was challenging to navigate because we had different ideas about the way we practiced, and we, but that worked out. You know, we ended up being in separate little houses, and I was able to close in more and spend a lot of time with the practices, with the meditative practices. And what happened was interesting because what first started to happen was I started to wake up to the mistaken beliefs that I had had around the practices I had been doing before. Only because, not because someone was sitting there teaching me something else, but because, well, yes, that's true. I was listening to Chula Dasa and he was teaching me, and it was that, but also it was because of the actual sitting there with my mind and watching and seeing what's true for sure. Seeing what's experientially true, seeing what's actually happening. And that gave clarity. A lot of things happened. A lot of insights happened. All of the practices I had been doing, all of the books I had been reading, which weren't very many, I actually restricted myself a lot, but the spiritual books I was reading, which were very few, but everything made perfect sense. I understood what was meant to be taught, what was meant to be said all along. I understood what was trying to be said. I understood what my teachers had said. I understood what it meant, and it was clear, and it was blissful and glowy, and there was so much gratitude. And like, I remember feeling a slight bit of ill will towards someone that was in the retreat in my mind. One day, around all this, when all this was going on, when things were glowy, and I remember it falling away, and I remember what that felt like, and it was so foreign and unfamiliar for that to fall away that easily, because this is something that actually had been, you know, like that was, you know, that person really deserved my being pissed off, quite honestly, and I'd believed that for quite some time. So just, and I remember it just falling away, and gratitude is what arose. There was, like, in the absence of ill will, gratitude. So all this, like, really blissful, cool stuff, you know? I couldn't get pissed off. I didn't feel anxious for about a couple weeks. No, you don't understand. And I didn't feel depressed for a much longer period of time. Not that I'm like a serious depressor, but depression person, but like I do have this low-level depression that's cycles. That's just the way it's been for, you know, that's the way it goes. And, but I had watched that for months and months, really watched that cycle, and so it didn't surprise me anymore, but it just, it wasn't happening, and like everything made sense and was clear, and I was grateful to everyone. And that's what's true, actually. And it felt really lovely. And it did stay for some time, but I was also in retreat. And though there were challenges there, it was less than what's happening this year. So, or less than what happens in the regular world when you're not in retreat. In some ways. And so, I also remember understanding clearly that there was a lot left to learn, like that probably a lot of which could never be learned, and that was perfectly fine. I also remember realizing there was more to uncover and more to come up and purify or like be cleared, and that was fine. See, that's called equanimity. It's an amazing place to be, contented, not ecstatically, energetically happy, and not, like, no extremes, just pretty much able to deal. And so I know that I understood that that was possible, I experienced that was possible, and I experienced what it was like without to have that little conflict in your own mind and to be accepting of your own shortcomings, as well as other people's, to whatever extent. And it was a great extent, actually. And now I appreciate that a lot. So that all happened, and And then, and even without, even though I wasn't totally, I wasn't buying into the magical thinking arena that I had been, there was still, you know, a real strong desire for pleasantness to continue. And so, you know, of course, there was just a strong desire. And yet I wasn't interfering with anything around that for a while. So then leaving retreat was pretty challenging. So just that in and of itself is a lot, actually. And more than I even realized at the time. And also I was most solidly, deeply in retreat at the very end. So, you know, it was a big shift to come back into the world. And Chula Dasa and Nancy were super helpful because they let me and my husband come live out here for a few months, which was extremely valuable. And then lots of different things happened. But what happened over the past year is a lot of life stuff really crashed. I mean, really exploded. And it was like, I've heard my friends say, God, that's a shit show. And I'm not really used to using that term, but it's true. Like, that's a real accurate term when it applies. And so just a whole bunch of life things. And they were, and even before all that was happening in full force, you know, I was struggling with being, you know, like wanting to be able to re-access that kind of clarity, wisdom, and love. In a day-to-day basis, and I was pissed off inside, and I was acting defiant, and a lot, and still some of that's there, but it's a little less. So, and just, you know, really upset and hurt and sad, and then. But then also there was the part of me not wanting to look at the other things that needed to be dealt with and not wanting to face the fact that there's still all this stuff. Like, I didn't think that I would go back to certain behaviors. I didn't think that I would resort to certain coping strategies that do not work, never worked, and that I thought that I was past. I didn't think that would happen, and it happened. And it does happen. And so I was, you can see how that, I was doing all the things that we know not to do in order to change. I mean, I was blocking myself, and I am sometimes, I mean, still, but I can, you know, like, you get to see it more clearly sometimes than others, and being out here helps a lot. So it helps a lot. And so doing that, I see, I've also been doing a lot of work with, in addition to the meditation practice that we've all been gifted, and in the daily practices that I have, I've been working with some yoga people who are really gifted at understanding how the physical manifestations of our mental and emotional states, and how those play out, and how to work with that, and how to treat yourself with kindness, and how to be patient, and how to stay in feeling what you're feeling right now. And I resisted it because it's a habit that's been going on longer than the wisdom that's that's starting to flower. It has, you know, trying to, the little buds opening. And I didn't want to accept that. So, so that's pretty painful, you know, when you know better, like really know, because you can't forget. You can't forget once you know. I used to, in retreat, when all this was very fresh, I would write every day. I'd write to myself. And I'd write Smriti in Sanskrit, which means remember, remember. I was really Sanskrit was, I'm not as connected with Sanskrit right now, but it's a powerful language, and the Pali is quite similar, and it's very powerful. Those words have power. Smriti. And so, because I didn't want to forget it all, and then I would be upset if I felt like I couldn't access as easily. So you can't forget. So when you can't totally forget, but then you're acting like you've forgotten, there's a bigger conflict than you've ever experienced in your entire life. It's a bigger conflict. And the beauty of it is you can't forget. Totally. So, what does this have to do with you being here in retreat? What does this have to do with meditation now, here, today, this week, you know? I've been gifted with listening to some of you. Some of you shared with me a little bit about your practice, which is, a huge gift. And I see, you know, I see over and over again how everyone has pain. I know I'm going to cry. And I thought that wouldn't be cool, you know. Because, I'm not supposed to do that when you're up here. But I decided that that's not true. I was like, God, that's not PC to cry up there. But I decided that PC meant personal correctness rather than political correctness. And this is personally correct. Thank you. I see how everybody hurts in one way or another, you know? And so, you know, you've got this gift that you can use. And it does work. It absolutely works. And, I mean, it doesn't mean that life is going to be all happy all the time. It does mean that you have the opportunity to learn how to navigate this as a human, not as, you know, like, with all your faults and with all your brilliance, which you can't even see. Which you can't even see. And the thing that keeps us, the only thing that keeps us from seeing the brilliance, the only thing, is because we don't accept things about ourselves, or we don't want to look at them. God, it's just fucked up, you know? And it's easier for me to get upset when I see it in someone else. And, I mean, that also shows me that I'm not alone, which is super helpful. It's easier for me to see it in other people and to feel that kind of sadness sometimes. I mean, I can feel it and see it myself, and that brings up a lot too. So the gift of us being together and being able to practice is something that most people never have. And I mean, for some reason, for whatever reason, I've been given like a million chances and like months and months and months of time to do this, and I don't know how I got that lucky. Well, I needed that much time. You guys probably don't. You don't need to do as long as me. But still. And so I see it, and I see that the only thing blocking us from seeing our brilliance, from realizing what's absolutely true, from realizing the truth of this amazing existence, is that we block ourselves in various ways, unintentionally, only because we believe it's the right thing to do, only because there's fear, only because there's fear of seeing something that we don't want to look at. And the thing is, I found out, at least briefly, on the other side of that fear, when you just go ahead and let go, because it's really a surrender, it's really not a doing. The thing that's on the other side of the fear of letting go into what's true and what's real, and like letting go of believing the false things that we believe about ourselves, is just more amazing than we can ever imagine. And we're just all right there, like this close, all the time. Especially all of you and us in this room. And that's why we meditate. That's why we read Chula Das's book. That's why we practice. That's why we sit there and learn. What are the five hindrances? I was thinking of just doing a lecture on the five hindrances, but that just was too boring. And I mean, I've done it. I mean, it's great. It's really it's valuable. The five hindrances are amazing. Why are they valuable? I did a teaching called The Five Opportunities. Because I couldn't call them hindrances. I just couldn't sit up there. And first of all, who wants to go to hear somebody talk about the five hindrances, the five obstacles? And it sounds like so depressing. I'd rather stay home and watch a movie and drink a beer or whatever, anything. Clean the kitchen. And they're opportunities. Every time something comes up in meditation that's, okay, help me out here, laziness, doubt, attraction to objects of the senses, aversion. One more. Ill will. I said aversion. There's one more and I can't remember.
Worry due to anxiety.
Due to worry and remorse. Anxiety due to worrying about what hasn't happened yet, or worrying about what we did that we shouldn't have done. Or worry about what's going to happen to us because we did what we shouldn't have done. Oh, gosh. That was such a... Oh, anyway, that's another thing. No wonder I forgot that one. That one was like the biggest one for me. And is sometimes still. Still is. See? Denial at work. Constantly in all of us. So the five hindrances are opportunities, because every time one of those comes up, every time we have an anxiety about something that we think might happen, it shows us, it gives us a message, it gives us a teaching. Every time we have an anxiety about something we shouldn't have done and we're worried about what will happen to us, we have an opportunity to change that. We can really change that. And then we have... purifications that happen in meditation. And if you haven't experienced them, hopefully yours will be mild. I don't know what that's like. Didn't have mild. Don't have mild to this day. Yet. But hopefully yours will be mild, but they may not be, and it doesn't matter because it is what it is. It's only showing you what's there. It can't show you what's not there. Every time a memory comes up, every time something comes up that frightens you, every time something comes up that feels like that you dissociate from, which I didn't even know I did. I've been dissociating all my life. I didn't even know I did it until this year. Every time something happens that you can't see right then, it's okay if you don't see it right then because you can't, but every time something comes up, it's the opportunity. We're hitting smoke signals all the time, constantly. Of exactly what needs to be seen. It comes up to be seen. Well, we can't see it. And so we have the opportunity to see it in meditation, and we learn about how to be mindful. So we have mindfulness. We use our mindfulness. And we have a practice that cultivates meditative joy. Like, we get permission to sit around and be blissful for hours. I mean, if that happens, if you're fortunate enough. And even if... I mean, it will come. It does. You can't stop it if you sit there and do. It comes. You can stop it. Okay. But and we get permission to be blissful and joyful and be in the joy, because a joyful mind is a unified mind, and a joyful mind is not that disturbable, comparatively speaking. And that is a mind that can allow the purifications to come up and be with them and sit with it. And that is a mind that has enough of the sub-minds online or on board, or however you want to think about it. I used to think about a train sometimes. Come on board. And I had a lot of time to make stuff up. So it's online, enough of the sub-minds online to really be present when an insight does pop up. And they just pop up unexpectedly when you're just there watching. And you're not trying to run the show, and you're not trying to drive the train or the plane. So all these things that are happening for you every single time you sit, I guarantee there's a million teachings arising for you. And if you catch a fraction of them, because they repeat themselves, so they're real kind. They're real kind. The same one comes up. The same ones come up over and over and over and over and over and over. So you get a lot of opportunities. You don't have to catch them all. And then, voila, when you catch the essence of something that deep inside of you that wants to be seen for what it is, and accepted for what it is, and held for what it is, and you're able to, even for a little while, and you're able to see that, experience that, and know that for what it is, and you're able to hold it, then that liberates. It liberates the little pesky thing that all it wanted to do was be seen. All it wanted to do was be known and accepted. And unfortunately, see, when you get, this is the cool part about the repetition thing, is when you really do accept that aspect of the unknown, of what's currently unknown, or that aspect of the subconscious that needs to be seen, when you accept that aspect, then all the repetitions about that one will stop. And that's a chunk. So you've gotten rid of a chunk instead of just this tiny bit. And when you meditate, you increase your chances of awakening, of culminating insight. And that's something that can't be, thank God, can't be completely undone. And that does purify some of the chunks all at once, so that's helpful. And then there's everything that's left still after an initial awakening. And and when you're able to remember, it's not that daunting. And when you can't remember for a little while, it feels overwhelming. And that's being human, and that's life. So you get a chance to be here in your daily meditation practice, if you take advantage of it. And I know you all mostly do that already. That goes a long way. It's so much better for me when I'm really diligent with my practice since I've been in the world. I never thought I wouldn't be completely diligent. I didn't believe that was even remotely possible, actually. And I was wrong. It's possible. And also when you lapse in your diligence, or maybe you're not doing it as long, or maybe you're skipping a number of days, those kinds of lapses will show you when you return. when you return, you will see what the lapses do, and it'll make you less likely to go there. You probably already know that, but you'll know it even more as time goes on, I think. Because it's almost like the stakes get higher, the things get bigger. I was trying to sort out why so many things happened to me at one time this year. To me. Why so many things happened to Renee. And it's not really important. I don't know that it really matters. And I don't know that I have an answer. However, I do believe that there is a there is somewhat of a tendency or a, somewhat of a, I think oftentimes when there's the deeper things or when there's like more, when it's almost like the whatever evil forces are left of the ego, get like, it's almost like they're on steroids. The more you know, or the more, like, the more insight that happens, or the more powerful the truth becomes within, the more powerful the truth becomes, the more accessible the truth is, and the stronger the opposing forces get. They like get pumped up, and or it seems like, and that may be true. I think it's true because it's happening in the world, and I think what's happening in the world in general, where it appears that evil forces are stronger and stronger, and whoa, all this spirituality and so much awakening and so much wisdom happening at the same time, and I think when that's happening in the world, we see that's also a reflection of what's happening, of what happens in our own experience. So, you know, part that made me feel a little better to at least believe that, whether it's true or not, that, you know, of course it's going to just, like, it's going to, maybe this is just going to get, like, the hurdles are going to get a little higher. Maybe you need to be able to get past this kind of shit, or no more progress is going to be made. And so I hope that wasn't a downer. I hope that was a little more of an upper. And I'm curious if you have questions about anything. And Jewel Das is here, so we have the master. Yes. Oh, that one, yeah.
So you said when you wrote to Chula Dasa from 3-year retreat that you felt doubtful that you could even, you know, master meditative stillness. And he wrote back and said, oh, of course you can. And then he spoke later about the 5 hindrances of doubt. And it feels like 5. Doubt. But it's only one of them.
But, doubt is the one that's listed 5th normally.
Right. But
I think.
When it comes up for me again and again, and it's doubt in my own ability to advance and to achieve insight and so forth, it really is very convinced that it's serving a purpose and that getting rid of it would be a bad mistake. And I'm wondering if you guys can tell me if there's any baby in that bathwater, or if, you know, if it's safe to chuck it all together, because
the doubt.
Yeah, because I know I'm protecting something when I'm holding on to that doubt. But is that just some old learned thing from when I was 2.5, or, you know, whatever the source of these purifications is? Or is there anything? Do I need to listen to it when it says, no, you need me. You can't dissolve me. You can't poke a pin in me. You need me.
Well, that's a great question. And I do think it comes from when we're 2.5 or whatever. I mean, I know that there are things that happen when we're very young that shape that, and then we get to keep reshaping it. And so you now have more of a choice being an adult and all. And yet at the same time, when the gut stuff is triggered, it's a little tricky. It's a lot tricky because it hijacks your cerebral cortex, puts you right into the limbic system and freaks you out. So, however, mindfulness and meditation give you a tool to work with that, that most people wouldn't ever have. And the doubt, back to the doubt, is what if you made a deal with your doubt? I don't know, this just popped up for me, and said, hey, doubt, healthy doubt that I need to have in order to discern what's healthy, what's helpful, what's right, or what's good to do, what's best, what's optimal. You know, that healthy doubt that helps you stay in alignment with what's true and is that part. Just make a deal. That part stays. That part stays. No problem. Everybody else, chuck it. There's no baby in that bathwater. Because you absolutely have no... There's absolutely no doubt that you are, not only can you continue to on this path, and not only will insight arise, but it will actually, and not, it will for you at some, or it will arise at some point. So it might as well be Andrea in this lifetime, right now.
All of the five hindrances exist because they serve a purpose. They exist because they serve a very valuable purpose. What makes them hindrances is how we respond to them. And the fact that our conditioned way of responding to them, the way that our whole culture and society conditions us to respond to these five innate tendencies, is what makes them problematic. Doubt has its positive side. To respond to doubt in a healthy way leads you to look at, okay, you might say you're having doubt about whether you're ever going to achieve the results, the goals of the practice or not. Right? That's the kind of doubt you have. Can I really do this? Does this work? Am I really... am I wasting my time, or am I doing? And that's the purpose of doubt, is to raise those questions. Now, how you respond to them, the very unhealthy way of responding to doubt is that when doubt arises, doubt's uncomfortable, doubt's worrisome, and that's to quit and to give up and to go hide and go do something else, or try to forget the doubt. A healthy response to it is to examine. And if you look at your practice and you look at the fruits of it, then that dispels your doubt, because you see that your practice has been showing results. And if you look at those who have achieved the benefits of the practice, and you talk to them and you listen to them, then that gives you confidence in the practice. You can say to yourself, okay, What I'm doing is what these people have done, and it's worked for them. So then you come back to, ultimately, where doubt always comes back to, we can doubt all kinds of other things, but it always comes back to, yeah, but maybe I'm, And I, quite honestly, this is where the Christian notion of original sin, the Judeo-Christian notion of original sin, is we all have in us this kind of self-doubt. Some of us admit it and deal with it, and some of us run away from it our whole lives, and some of us accept it as true and spend our whole life trying to hide it from everyone else, and we're living in this kind of hypocrisy of, I'm this rotten, lousy person compared to everybody else, but by God, I'm not going to let anybody else know it, That's unhealthy doubt, as soon as you start to have a thought like, maybe I can't do this. Well, there's that word, right? That I, I am this fixed, separate, abiding entity, and hey, if I came out of the factory defective, I'm defective forever, right? And it's all an illusion. The you are an aggregate in so many ways, of so many things, of so many past experiences, and of so many responses to those experiences. That's what you are. You are this amalgam of traits and tendencies that have been formed through the process of living your life up to this point. And there's no epoxy holding that all together. It's completely subject to change. And that's what the practice is about. It's allowing us to change the way these aggregates function together. What is a purification anyway? You know, where we come in contact with some part of ourselves that either we don't like or that is extremely painful for us. Purification is acceptance. It's integration. The acceptance part is we stop separating the rest of ourself from this one part of ourself. And of course, part of the problem is that one part of ourself, because of the antipathy that the rest of us has had towards that part of ourself, it's rejecting the rest of us. Those are the things we need to get purified of. And the bigger, wiser part of us that develops through the meditation and through the Dharma practice is the part that opens the process of acceptance, that says to this part that we've always objected, that we've always rejected, I'm not going to reject you anymore. No more. Come on, tell me all about what you're about. Let's be here and be together. And as the next thing that happens after that, when we can succeed in accepting these parts of ourselves that we haven't been able to accept in the past, then the process of integration, those parts change, and the whole of you changes so that you've integrated something that was always a part of you into a greater whole. You become a person with more integrity. Interesting word, right? Integrity, right? You become more of a whole person rather than a person that's broken up into these different parts that form little alliances at different times. At different times, different alliances are running the show, and all the other parts that weren't included in the alliance are protesting against it, and you have all these inner conflicts.
Inner conflicts, yes.
Right.
And that's true.
That's what we're after, is to integrate ourselves. Now, doubt, healthy doubt, leads us to reflect and to assure ourselves that, yes, my practice is producing results. Yes, this is something that works. I can see that it works in others. Yes, these things that I aspire to are achievable. And then when you come to the place where there's a little voice that's saying, yeah, but maybe not I, maybe not me, just remind yourself that here you go. You're assuming you're somehow this separate, singular, unchanging self. That, you know, it's like this is an I that can't do it. Well, it's not. And it may be an I in the form that you may have constructed this I in a form today that is limited in certain ways, but you're totally capable of making that into a different I tomorrow. So it's that understanding that counteracts the unhealthy part of doubt. And it's the reflection and examination that is actually serving the beneficial purpose of the reason that healthy doubt is there. Healthy doubt might cause you to go and talk to your teacher or spiritual guide. Healthy doubt may cause you to modify your practices. Healthy doubt can lead to positive action, or a lot of times healthy doubt can lead to a sense of affirmation and a sense of redetermination. And yes, I can see what this has done, and I can see that my doubt has been making me slack off. So now is the time for me to set that aside, now that I've reflected and I know the value of it. So that's the baby that you don't want to throw out. But this paralyzing doubt, you know, the unwholesome doubt is a kind of faith. It's a faith in failure, right? And the opposite of doubt, faith is the opposite of doubt. Healthy doubt keeps us from being on faith, sucked into a bunch of nonsense, and wasting years doing things that we shouldn't do, or throwing tons of money at something that's never going to, you know, give us what we're looking for, or send us chasing fruitlessly after all kinds of sense pleasures or imaginary accomplishments and things like that. Yeah. So.
Ellie.
I think I have kind of a healthy, doubtful question, which is the advice I was given, which was really great, was to, in my practice, kind of start looking for joy in my meditation while I'm sitting, finding it. And a question I have about kind of cultivating that joy is, it seems to kind of, for me, internally conflict with the concept of no self.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like I'm kind of stroking an ego that doesn't really exist. So I'm just wondering how those sort of things gel together.
Great question. I remember being really struggling with cultivating joy because I felt that it was cultivating an attachment, just the way you're describing. And so that took me a while to resolve. What you're doing by noticing and savoring the joy that's already there, or the pleasant sensation, or the pleasure that's there, is you're helping to balance a mind that's out of balance. Our minds, because of trying to detect danger, tend to turn toward the what's wrong and what we need to fix. And so and then we get wrapped up in worry loops, and we direct it in ways that are unhelpful, because then we're trying to just always fix something that we think is wrong, and then it can tie into a lot of the self-doubt and the things that we have toward ourselves, the negative beliefs we have that are false toward ourselves. So especially in our culture. So that's part of what that does, is it helps to train the mind to look for pleasure first, preferentially. And then actually what happens is it's a lot easier for you to look at the doubt and the grief and the anger, because there's a peaceful calm. It provides a peaceful, calm, and unified mind. There was another part that I was going for. So it balances out the mind, and it also helps to create a mind that's able to handle whatever does come up. Those are the big things that it does. And so in that way, what you're doing is you're taking something that's already true and already there, that has nothing to do with an individual self, and actually what's actually true about you and about all of us, the truth of us, is love and joy, and it's very joyful and pleasure, what's absolutely true. So you're just actually taking yourself closer to the truth, not farther away from the truth. When we get mired in the negative, we go farther away from the truth. So that, it took me a while to figure that out, but you don't have to necessarily do that. You can actually talk to people. And I'm sure Chula Dasa has more to add to that. But I sat with it a lot for a while. And once I could reconcile that it wasn't an attachment, I mean, you know, the other thing is the part that sits there and says, oh, I don't know about that. That's the part that thinks having, you know, like experiencing, preferentially experiencing pleasure is an indulgence and that's somehow wrong. And that's like, I don't deserve, there can be the, I don't deserve that. I didn't believe I deserved happiness, actually. So why would I want to, why would I feel okay about cultivating that if I didn't deserve it, you know? That's an I. See, the I is the part that's going, oh no, but. It's like the little devil on the shoulder in the old cartoons, and then there's the angel. Because the pleasure, the joy, that's what's closer to the truth anyway. And when we're in joy, when our awareness is very strong, and powerful and clear, that's when we're not as tied to a self. We're way more congealed around a self when we're analyzing and like worrying and that kind of thing. That's congealing around a self. But the expansive, joyful awareness, that's really what's true. Anyway.
Most of the time, it's very difficult for people to distinguish. Well, the vast majority of people have absolutely no idea that there's a difference between joy and happiness. But they are completely two different things. Joy is a particular state of mind. And whenever the mind is in the state of joy, it gives rise to the feeling, the mental feeling of happiness. Happiness is a feeling, and joy is a mental state. And so the two always occur together. And if you look at the happiness as a kind of pleasure, then you can be concerned that, this is dangerous. It's like all these other sense pleasures. I can become addicted to it. I could end up pursuing it. And in fact, much of the Theravadan tradition is very austere and very strict and, you know, guard the senses and, you know. And so in the popular versions of Theravadan teachings that are circulating nowadays, the Mahasi style mindfulness practice, you come to the point in the practice where joy spontaneously arises, and your teacher instructs you to notice it and go back to the rise and the fall. And it's referred to as a defilement of insight. And there's all these warnings that, you know, don't do jhana practice because you'll just get hooked to the pleasure and you'll just want to spend the rest of your life sitting there in pleasure. And that's total nonsense.
It's not true.
If you get to the place in your meditation practice where true joy arises, and there's no way. I mean, temporarily for a little while, yeah, of course you're going to indulge in the fascination of this, but you know, that's one of the things that the First Noble Truth of Dukkha tells us, is that there is no form of pleasure that is ultimately that satisfying. And if you've reached the point in meditation where joy is the source of the pleasure you're feeling, then you've also learned so many other things that you're not going to get hooked by it. You don't need to worry about it. And most particularly valuable is when you can distinguish the mental pleasure from the joy that it produces, and you begin to appreciate the nature of the joy itself. What the joy is, the amount of joy that you have is a reflection of how unified your mind is, how integrated it is. It's like when all the parts are working together smoothly, perfectly, you know, it's just humming along, you know. And it's very powerful. And yes, it produces happiness. The happiness that joy produces allows you to confront all the pain of the world from a place of equanimity. Joy gives birth first to tranquility and then to equanimity. And so joy is one of the most important and valuable things that will come out of meditation. So you need not be afraid that you're somehow going to, that it's going to be a defilement of your practice. Sure, and as I say, you might get caught up in it for a little while, and that's all right. I mean, it's, well, compared to all the other things you've done, ha.
True.
Could you talk a little bit about the difference between the state you just described and suspecting that you're sitting in subtle dullness? And suspecting that you're actually just sitting in subtle dullness?
Ah, yeah.
Yes, when you're sitting in subtle dullness, that's pleasurable too. We all know that pleasure, even if we've never meditated. We know, that's why sitting in front of a television is kind of, you slip into a state of dullness and there's a pleasure associated with it. It's one of the things that alcohol does. There's a lot of things that produce, you know, you sit out under a beach umbrella on the beach and the surf's rolling in and you enter into this state of blissful dullness. But it has a different quality to it. The joy actually comes with a tremendous amount of energy. And so in that regard, the pleasure of dullness and the happiness of joy are totally opposite. When you're experiencing the happiness of joy, your mind is vibrantly alive and awake and alert. It's not that laying on the couch after Christmas dinner kind of feeling, you know. It's that warm, fuzzy, comfortable, yeah, sort of half there and half not. You know, it's the mental state that you're in is one that has kind of shifted the way your mind works. And so you're seeing and experiencing the positive. It's like it's just leaping out at you, or your mind is pouncing on it, or however you want to think of it. And one of the things that joy teaches you is that no matter how much pain and discomfort there may be, there's always something positive present. There's always something to, and joy allows you to see that. It doesn't blind you, but what it does is it blunts the negativity, the negative reaction. Your dukkha, suffering, is the mind's reaction to an experience. It's the rejection of what is. You know, when it's the last piece of halva on the plate, it's the rejection of the piece that there's not, of the fact that there's not 10 more pieces there, right? You know, or when you lose something that you have, it's the rejection of that truth. And joy is the acceptance of what is. It's the radical acceptance of what is. And it comes from energy, and it gives you energy. And so they're very different in that way. When you only have read about it, you may experience subtle dullness. And the thing is that subtle dullness causes your mind to be less active, and so it seems like there's a lot less distraction. And it feels good and soft and fuzzy and warm and everything. So when you've only read about it, you can be in a state of subtle dullness and say, wow, I'm right up there with Ramana Maharshi and the rest of the cool guys. Okay.
I want to read one more poem. Last night I have this thing that I do with this book where We used to call it doing a mo. And you just open it and see what you open to. And it was kind of cool what happened. Because, anyway, this. So you already heard one part that happened. Here's the other one. And this one is by, let me remind myself, make sure I'm right, Rabia. Die before you die. Oh, light's getting dim. Ironic, but one of the most intimate acts of our body is death. So beautiful appeared my death, knowing who then I would kiss. I died 1,000 times before I died. Die before you die, said the Prophet Muhammad. Have wings that feared ever touched the sun? I was born when all I once feared I could love.